Depression is a scourge of the modern world. It's projected that by 2030, mental health problems, particularly depression, will be the leading cause of mortality and morbidity globally. That's from the University of Melbourne. One in six Kiwis will experience a major depressive disorder at some point in their lives. One in five females, one in eight males. One in seven young New Zealanders go through that experience before age 24. At Stanford University in California, they ran an unusual study involving the use of ketamine. This intervention of theirs was supported by America's Society for Neuroscience in Anesthesiology. Ketamine, as you may know, was originally an anesthetic and a horse tranquilizer, and then it became appropriated as a party drug. And now work goes on all the time to purpose it for depression because it's fast acting. But there are still hurdles it has to clear. To cut a long story short, results vary, as they say. Sometimes it seems like a wonder drug. Sometimes the side effects can't be tolerated. Prince Harry wrote in his memoir, Spare, about taking it to help him deal with his mother's death. Across the United States, hundreds of clinics have opened offering intravenous infusions. One company was considering opening a ketamine clinic at its corporate headquarters. Pharmaceutical companies are developing over-the-counter ketamine products like lozenges and topical creams, reports New Scientist. At Stanford, they did something quite different with ketamine. Neuroscientist Dr. Boris Heifetz runs the Heifetz Lab at the Stanford School of Medicine. He's an associate professor there. Hello, Boris.
How are you today, Jim?
I'm very well, and thank you for joining us. It's great. A good many medical and pharmaceutical scientists are trying to refine techniques for using ketamine. That's not quite what you did with it. Can you explain, please, Boris, what it was you did?
Sure. One of the differences between ketamine and conventional antidepressants like Prozac, say, is that ketamine is profoundly psychoactive, meaning it has a pretty pronounced effect. People call it a dissociative, where you seem to kind of be disconnected from your body and thoughts, and may give you a different sort of perspective on reality, so to speak. And one of the questions that has really dogged this field of understanding how ketamine works is, how much is that effect important? How much is the trip, so to speak, an important part of the therapeutic effect? There's a twin concern there, which is, if you know you've got the drug in these double-blind trials, then the trial's not really blind. And there's this question of, well, if you know you got the drug and you think the drug is going to work for your depression, how much can we attribute your improvement to your expectations versus the drug itself?
And who did you... So you set out to administer the drug to certain individuals, but they were undergoing surgery, all of them, weren't they?
Yes. And what we did is we took advantage of a situation. I'm an anesthesiologist that we encounter quite frequently. We have patients coming quite often who have varying degrees of depression, and they're coming for surgery, whether it might be knee surgery, back surgery, some abdominal surgeries. So we basically use this as an opportunity to test these questions. If you don't know which group you're in truly because you're unconscious, because you're being anesthetized for surgery, do you still get the same benefit from ketamine if you weren't there for it, so to speak? Does that make sense so far?
Absolutely. So these patients, 40 of them, I think, with moderate to severe depression, administered or not administered ketamine, they woke up after surgery not knowing if they'd had the drug or not, Boris, yeah?
Yes, and the type of anesthesia we used has less than 1% incidence of recall, meaning the likelihood that they would have remembered anything under surgery, let alone, you know, a drug experience, is actually quite small. And we asked them at the end of the whole study, 14 days later, what drug did they think they got?
when they came around, how did you work around the fact that ketamine can produce this trippy sort of effect in the brain, which you would think would be a giveaway?
These folks, it is very difficult for them to figure out at that stage, what are they feeling? They're emerging from anesthesia, and the ketamine effects are largely gone from their body at that point.
Did you talk to them soon after the surgery?
Yeah. So what we were most interested in was the first 3 days after surgery. So post-op day 1, 2, and 3. That time period is when many of the studies over the last 15 years of ketamine, that's typically when they assess their primary effect. They want to know, it's a rapid acting antidepressant. Prozac takes 6 weeks. Ketamine takes 6 hours, and the peak effect is typically in that 1 to 3 day window.
So when you first talked to them post-surgery, Boris, especially those in the placebo group who hadn't been given anything, but also the ones who had, what did they say?
So this, when I talked to them, I also had no idea what they got. I recall so clearly there were two patients at least where I talked to them the next day, and it was infectious. Their enthusiasm, their resilience. They told me things like, this is unlike any surgery I had before. Like, I have the energy to do things I didn't do. I feel like I want to dance. These are people who just had major surgery in some cases, abdominal surgery, spine surgery, like things that are, you're not up and about typically. Yeah. But mentally, they were fully, fully present. And at that's when that happens, when I talk to these folks, and I can, there's something that people say in mental health, like when you can feel it, when the patients make you feel a certain way, that's when you know something is happening. All right. And I swore at that moment, like, if these folks are not in the ketamine group, I'm going to leave science, because I don't, or else I want to know what it is that did this, because you don't see stuff like that after surgery. Typically, all of our literature on surgery and mental health is that actually surgery is a big stressor, that we think about surgery and anesthesia as things that are going to make depression worse, that are going to lead to more opioid use, worse pain outcomes. And yet here, these patients are completely violating my own expectation and telling me that they're, ready to get up and dance. And they have, a new lust for life. And then, I wouldn't be telling you this except that at the end, a year later, when we finally broke the blind, they got placebo. It was actually unreal to me that it could be that real, that not only they feel it, but I felt it. On average, about half of the patients had cut their symptom load in half, and about 30% of the patients were what we would consider in remission from major depressive disorder for the first 3 days after surgery. So some of them clearly had these, transformative experiences. Some of them had sort of I feel better. I'm not really sure why. Some of them really felt no change. And one thing that was clear was it did not seem to be predictable based on what drug they got.
Dr. Boris Heifetz is with us. He runs the Heifetz Lab at the Stanford School of Medicine, where he's an associate professor. And these reactions and feelings, these significant mood improvements, weren't just the result of being in distracting surroundings with comforting health professionals and being made to feel special. These feelings then lasted longer than that.
Yeah, so this is where, of course, it gets complicated, and we didn't expect the result that we got. And our result, again, just to summarize, was that we're testing ketamine, and not only do all the ketamine patients in the ketamine group, who didn't know what they got because they were under general anesthesia, not only did they get better quite a bit, but also folks in the placebo group got a lot better.
Yeah.
In a study of magic mushrooms, psilocybin for major depression, these studies are have a very heavily selected patient population, meaning thousands apply, only a few make it into the study. So there's already a level of excitement, specialness, uniqueness. We also selected from thousands of patients to get these 40 patients. There are a lot of patients that come in for surgery, but not a lot of patients with major depression of moderate or worse severity can actually usually have their life together enough to show up for an elective surgery. So we're looking already for a pretty, small group of patients. And when we got these patients, we held on to them. In many cases, when they told us about their lives, their mental health history, their trauma, they weren't telling these things to their surgeons typically because the surgeon is interested in the surgery. They had someone to listen to. So they really, they bonded with our team. We did, extensive, multi-hour assessments before surgery, getting to know them. And you're entrusting your life to the anesthesiologist and to the study team to really look after you. Now, that leap of faith and that, that all the expectations and the things we tell them, all of those elements really come together where the patients have gone through something, whether they remember it or not. They have the scars and the bandages to prove it. They had surgery and they knew that they were in a study where they might have had a chance to get a potentially transformative treatment. Those are the elements, really, that placebo doesn't do it justice. Placebo effect makes it sound as if there wasn't anything wrong with them to begin with. That is absolutely not, when you think about what does it take to inspire hope in patients who have not had hope, that's not trivial.
So positive expectations, expectancy bias. We've all heard by now that the placebo effect in medicine is powerful even when we know it's operating on us. What you gave people is what you just said before. What you gave them was hope, yeah?
That's our interpretation. Now, if we had known what we were going to get at the beginning of the study, obviously we didn't know the result beforehand, we would have done a lot more to really nail that down. Our study doesn't prove that by any means because we simply didn't measure their expectations. It's entirely possible that the effect of the drug itself operates on your expectations, that there's a complex interplay that we really have only begun to untangle.
Did the effects last once they had been administered, or not administered, but given hope? Did the effects last in these patients?
So the truth is we don't know. We basically stopped our follow-up at 2 weeks and did not plan for any further follow-up. Now, we've been in touch with some of these folks, and that's not really a systematic statement, but, some really continue to do well. They implemented changes in their lives that, we think may contribute to their long-term wellness, but we didn't measure.
Okay, but the effects you've described, you also saw after a fortnight. And can I ask if the ones that you have anecdotally followed up, just casually been in touch with, they include people who weren't given ketamine during surgery? They include people just given hope?
Yeah. And it really, I just want to emphasize, it's not a matter of simply thinking yourself better, wishing yourself better. That's not the full effect. It's, a very kind of complex interplay of condition responses to medical care, expectations, relationships, and some things that are still hard, I think, to put into words.
Nevertheless, does it tell us that hypothetically, because ethics would never allow this to happen, you would never countenance this, but hypothetically, if your lab were to announce a partnership with a pharmaceutical company with a product, which was a fake product, to treat depression with claimed astonishing therapeutic effects, we might see therapeutic effects before, the news got out and a scandal ensued. I'm saying we might actually see an effect if the patient thought they'd been given this new drug.
Unfortunately, this is the history of drug development around the world. This is why the United States, it is for that reason we have the Food and Drug Administration. A study like that should never happen. And that is, a morally, wrong practice. I mean, I can state that as a pretty flat fact. Deception at that level is not ethical. the counterpoint is, and you raised this before, open label placebo, meaning even when you tell patients you're giving them a placebo, it still has a therapeutic effect. And I want to emphasize, it's not just, I'm giving you a sugar pill, feel better. It's not it. It's actually a very structured intervention. There's, I'm giving you a pill, you're coming in for care. Then I'm giving you a therapy called placebo. It works in your brain through these circuits. We have these studies that back that up. Patients do better. This doesn't mean that it's all in your head. This is a real therapy.
Understood. But what is possibly happening in the brain, we infer, is that it can produce its own version of recovery and emphatically reduce depression and improve mood itself. I mean, the other aspect of what you found is that, you know, what the psychedelics like psilocybin are purported to do for depression, there may be no need for someone to traipse into the Peruvian jungle for an ayahuasca juice experience in order to rewire their lives. The answer's potentially inside us, isn't it?
The power is within us. And a lot of times, you know, those circuits, those pathways have gone unused for a long time. And it's a matter of waking them back up. Yeah, it may not require a trip to the Peruvian jungle. It would still require a fair amount of preparation rather than just kind of willy-nilly taking some magic mushrooms on a Tuesday morning before you go to work. I don't think that's going to do it for most people.
Dr. Boris Heifetz is with us. I mean, it may be that psychedelics alter your mental circumstances sufficiently, as might being in a hospital for surgery with all that apparatus, as you say, around someone would do. But it's still a reset of the brain. It's tantalizing. And inducing hope, is that the holy grail here, an epiphany, if you like, that's believable for the sufferer?
There's a complicated question there. Is it enough to induce hope? There are some people for whom it's not enough. That's I think also clear. And that was also evident in our study.
You see, people listening, and there'll be probably thousands listening to us right now in the throes of depression, worried about its recurrence maybe, or they fear that statistically it may arrive in their lives with family histories and so on. And we want to know what you have found might help them or their families and loved ones. If ketamine is a kind of, in some people, magic switch, an emphatic, rapid switch offering relief, whereas a placebo is not, but can nevertheless very quickly see an improvement in mood, it kind of gives other people the hope that they may not have to endure 6 months of desperation, you know, of depression. There is a kind of instant hope switch possible. It's just that there are a few factors playing into it, but it is actually a prospect, isn't it?
Why did we get the results we got? Probably because of all of the psychological and social support that we inadvertently provided. That's what, when you look at these studies of psilocybin that are coming out and ketamine as well. Again, there's a lot of psychological safety, psychological support, therapy hours that are going into these studies that you cannot ignore. Those are, again, what come back to this idea of non-drug factors. The drug may help to catalyze these changes in someone's life, but it's only part of the story.
I understand that, but billions have done it, got through depression without medication over the centuries. We just need something that cheats the brain. And I don't mean cheats in a pejorative sense, that tricks the brain into getting people well far faster if we can. And you actually seem to have done that.
That's a very generous interpretation of what we've done. Instead of the flipping the chemical switch with ketamine, it's possible that what we did was we took advantage of a highly charged situation of surgery. That could be the catalyst that you need for change. I've heard a lot of patients talk about how, they had a heart attack and they made, that woke them up and changed their lives. Really creating meaning around an event, that to me is the challenge in our daily lives? And, you know, how do you do that for patients? You know, and certainly how do you do that for patients in a 15-minute visit? We'll never know.
Yeah, no, I understand. And religion may not be on everyone's radar when they're in the throes of depression. And it's multifactorial, as you say, what you did, and the conclusions are complex. But they're also tantalising, aren't they, just finally, Boris? I mean, what you have achieved in some of those people is would seem to indicate a faster road than many people have had to walk down.
How can you create a moment for somebody that's intense and meaningful and potentially transformative? And we're right now playing around is the right word, but diving into this concept of actually using anesthetics to induce prolonged dream states. This is a lot like, you know, mimicking some of the aspects of psychedelics, except with drugs that are actually far safer, already approved, and, you know, in the hands of a licensed anesthesiologist, are incredibly safe. And, you know, just again, anecdotally, we've seen some truly remarkable experiences that patients with longstanding traumatic histories report. This is all, you know, I don't want to say too much. This is work that's very much very preliminary. We published one such case report where a woman who was attacked by a family member with defensive knife wounds came to the operating room. My colleague Harrison Chow is an amazing clinician. Induced this dreamlike state during her anesthetic. And what she told us when she woke up is that she transformed. She had the same nightmare of being attacked that she'd had for the last 2 weeks. The nightmares had made her sleepless and non-functional. And she dreamt of the attack. And then in her dream, again, this is under anesthesia, so she's not waking up from this dream. She goes past the attack, and she's now in her dream going to the emergency room. Now she's going to the operating room. Now she's back at home with her hand healed, running errands. And she wakes up and she's, you know, she's in tears, like it's over. And we follow her for a year and her symptoms are gone. This is one case. This is something we published last year. But that, you know, it's very much of a theme that patients have the capacity within themselves, when you sort of let them get out of their own way, when you silence the ego and let the dreams issue forth, when you know you can do that with psychedelics, you can do that with ketamine, you can do that maybe with this this dream therapy that we're looking at. Yeah, this is very much on the edge of respectable science, I think. But I think it's very captivating and speaks to the idea of how do you create meaningful transformation in life.
Gee, I can see what you mean. I think I saw it in, associated with your study when you said that it raises more questions than we have answers to. But they are fascinating questions, and the emerging answers are amazing too, aren't they?
That's keeps me getting out of bed every morning.
Great of you to talk to us, and thank you so much for your valuable time as well.
Thank you, Jim. I really appreciate you having me on.
Dr. Boris Heifetz, he runs the Heifetz Lab at the Stanford School of Medicine.